man and a woman shared a meal at the restaurant across from him. A woman in a burqa entered a halal butcher shop right next to the restaurant. Bicycles, mopeds, and the occasional car passed on at the end of the lane. "Looks normal. Too bad you don't know what normal for this neighborhood really looks, or more importantly, feels like. Trust your gut. Normal." Reese found himself wishing he had a pistol. There was a single step up into the doorway of most of the shops he had passed. This step had been replaced with a ramp. He turned the door handle and entered, a small bell announcing his arrival. Reese stepped just left of the door, as was his habit, to get out of the fatal funnel, and let his eyes adjust to the dark interior. A large table occupied the center of the store. On it were hardbound books that looked vintage, or even ancient, in origin.
"Buongiorno,"
Reese heard a voice say from the back of the store. Reese walked toward the voice, noting the bookshelves to his right and left. A distinctive mixture of leather, parchment, and dust was in the air, reminding Reese of his grandparents' attic when he was a kid. He got the impression that the store didn't see much in the way of foot traffic. It was quiet, like a museum with no visitors. The desk was offset to the right, in the back corner of the shop. There wasn't a cash register visible. Apparently, it wasn't that type of store. "Hi," Reese said, walking toward the desk. "I'm James Donovan. I believe you are expecting me." The desk appeared much too large for the space. It was adorned with stacks of papers and books. Behind it sat a man in a wheelchair. Even in the dim light, Reese could tell that he was cleanly shaven and dressed in a dark suit with a neatly trimmed full head of dark hair streaked with gray. It was impossible to tell how tall he had once been, but the cut of his jacket indicated a wide set of shoulders, with powerful arms to match. His left hand held an exquisitely decorated silver pen. His right was out of sight.
"Yes, Mr. Donovan," Abelard said, switching to English. "My former employer informed me that you would be stopping by today."
His English had the type of accent that did not make its country or region of origin discernible. Reese got the impression that that was the point. Abelard shut the drawer to his right, pushed himself back from the desk, and in what was an extremely efficient set of hand and arm movements on the wheels of his chair, positioned himself in front of his guest. He offered his hand.
"Pleasure, Mr. Donovan. I'm Saul Abelard."
Reese took the outstretched hand and felt the crushing grip of his host.
"Thank you for seeing me," Reese said. "It's one of the things I do, Mr. Donovan. When Tel Aviv calls, I try to accommodate. Director Katz informed me that he had briefed you up on my background and rather unique position in the world."
Abelard spun around and maneuvered back behind his desk.
"Please take a seat," he said,
directing Reese to one of two cherrywood-framed, leather-backed chairs. Reese unslung his backpack and set it, along with his helmet and one-size-too-small leather jacket, to the side of his seat. The former SEAL took a moment. He could sense that Abelard was sizing him up.
"Like the suit?"
he asked his guest.
"The suit?"
Reese asked.
"Soon after I left the hospital, I was wearing a comfortable white T-shirt and sweatpants. A man tossed a euro in my lap as he passed. He thought I was homeless. I decided I needed to go with the suit after that."
Reese didn't know if it was appropriate to laugh at the icebreaker. He smiled and said, "That makes sense."
"I don't get many Americans in here, Mr. Donovan, either for book restoration or for my more select services."
"Probably a good thing, on the select services side of things anyway."
"The director doesn't call often. It is much more common for me to call him."
"But you didn't, in the case of Nizar Katan." Abelard paused.
"No, I did not."
"And why is that?" Reese asked.
"Mr. Donovan, I am not in the habit of explaining my business, but I do acknowledge the level of importance placed on this matter by the director."
"What did you think Katan was going to do once you connected him with an Africa hand?"
"That Africa hand, as you say, was a sergeant in the French Foreign Legion. I've been his handler for going on 5 years now, Catan for just under a year. I tell you that because, though I am freelance and don't work for Tel Aviv, I do have an allegiance to my former home country. As I understand it, you pass the Mossad information if you become aware of any plans targeting Israeli citizens or infrastructure. That is part of the arrangement. But it didn't work this time, Reese said. No, it did not. As with most of my clients, I believed their intent was a liquidation.
An assassination, Reese said.
That's correct.
And when you saw that a plane went down in Burkina Faso?
I was not sure it was Catan and Le Drian.
Until?
Until Le Drian called me and requested assistance with extract.
Which you provided?
I did.
Why?
I did not yet know that Tel Aviv had an asset on board, but still, Mr. Donovan, it did give me pause.
Why was that?
I am not in the business of mass murder.
Just individual murders.
A subject I believe you know something about,
Mr. Donovan. Reese took a breath. His reputation had obviously preceded him. So why help get them out? Why not let the local or national level law enforcement or intelligence services detain them in Africa?
Because I am the, how would you say it in English, dot that connects them. Better to deal with them quietly.
But then Katz calls you.
He did. And I found out we had an asset on the plane.
So now the mission becomes finding them and taking them out with a Mossad hit team.
Yes. But then you show up, Mr. Donovan, and I am asked by Tel Aviv to assist you in any way I can. It's quite curious, really.
What is? Reese asked.
That you are here, and not a team from Caesarea. And there was not an active contract out on Alia Galin. Trust me, in my channels, I would have heard about it by now.
What does that tell you? Reese asked.
It tells me that this is not a simple act of terrorism, nor an assassination disguised as terrorism.
What do you mean?
Mr. Donovan, I have been in this chair for over 30 years. I can get around just fine. I've adapted, but my clock is ticking.
Your clock?
Oh, yes. Life expectancy for people with my spinal injury is far less than the average Italian. I have been patient, but I also need to speed things up a bit.
Speed what up?
When I was shot, I was doing my job.
I had purpose.
Then I woke up in a hospital bed without the use of my legs. I had to find that purpose again.
I can understand that. The purpose part, at least. Reese said, his mind drifting to a storm in the mid-Atlantic as he sailed for Africa years ago, leaving the death and destruction he had wrought in his wake. What did you do?
I sought solace where I felt most comfortable.
In books, Reese said.
That's right. My mother and father ran a used bookstore in my youth. I escaped into the pages of books that would filter through their small shop. After my father died, I helped my mother in the store. Those books transported me from Israel to places all around the world. My fondest memories are of reading books in the shop as a child.
So you learned to restore books and started this business?
Correct. I learned from the masters. What you see here in this store is more than a cover for action, Mr. Donovan. It's a life's work. These books still transport me from here, from this chair, back to my youth.
I see.
Some books arrive with water damage. You would be surprised what heat, dust, and insects can do to the pages, bindings, and spines. People transport books when they move and do not package them correctly. The changes in temperature and humidity, even altitude, can wreak havoc, Mr. Donovan. Books are adaptable, but if you ask too much of them, they will fall apart.
And you think that's what happened to you? Tel Aviv asked too much?
Oh, I am sure the Mossad psychiatrist would love to talk with me. Too bad they will never get the chance.
Why is that?
I am never going home, Mr. Donovan. I found my purpose.
In book restoration?
In part.
You were looking for someone.
I am.
The man who put you in that chair.
Someday I will get a lead. Then I will work him into my sights, Abelard said. And when I do, I will have more mercy than he had. No chair for him. He will go straight to the grave.
Is this what I am like? Rhys wondered. Is this how Katie sees me?
So what of Catan and Le Drian? Rhys asked.
I can't be certain. I met Catan once in person in Dubrovnik. He doesn't use cell phones.
And Le Drian?
I have never met him. Much of our communications have been electronic. Not my preference, but sometimes a necessity.
But you handle them both.
Handler may be the wrong term. I am more of an information broker, a connector.
Can you help me find them?
I can, but there is something else at play.
What?
Terrorism or assassination? What happened in Africa is most certainly both, but at the same time it is neither.
Did you always speak in riddles?
Bear with me, Mr. Donovan. The usual signals before and after the event were not present.
What does that tell you?
Now that I've met you, and from plugging in what I learned from Director Katz and from my own research before your arrival, I ask myself what is different about this tragedy.
And what do you think?
You, Mr. Donovan, you are what is different. You are sitting here in my bookstore. I think someone wanted to put you here.
Who?
Catan is the obvious choice, but in this business I have learned that the obvious is not always correct. If he led you here, I would think the next step is for you to learn what I know of Catan. That would lead you to the Balkans.
Well, then that's where I'm going to go.
Catan is baiting a trap. He led you right here. He's playing chess.
He may be playing chess, but I'm playing poker.
Ugh. That most American of card games. At least make it something civilized, like Baccarat.
Rhys felt an unfamiliar vibration in his pocket.
Excuse me, Rhys said, pulling out the phone that had arrived in the diplomatic pouch in Israel and hitting the message app.
Watch your back.
Rhys turned to look at the door. Chapter 56.
Do you have any weapons here? Rhys asked urgently as he got to his feet.
What is it?
Weapons, Rhys said again, looking from the door back to Abelard. What do you have?
I have this,
the former Mossad operative said, holding up the H&K P7 from the desk drawer.
And what's in the safe?
Abelard slid the pistol between his hip and the side of his wheelchair, spun the wheels, and rolled to the shelves that made up the wall to his right. He pulled two books from the shelf. Rhys heard a click.
Don't just stand there. Help me pull.
Rhys ran to the shelves and pulled where Abelard indicated. The shelves pulled away from the hinge to reveal the front of a safe. Abelard immediately positioned his chair to give him access to the mechanical lock, which he spun, while Rhys alternated between looking at the door and at the H&K pistol by Abelard's right hip. The bookseller rotated the lock back to zero and twisted the five-spoke handle to the right, retracting the bolts and allowing the steel door to swing outward.
Good thing I deal in more than just information, Abelard said.
Rhys stepped forward to get a better look. The safe was not huge by any standard. It had shelves on one side with books in various stages of repair, and another stacked with paperbacks with names Rhys recognized. Le Carré, Thor, Silva, de Villiers, Hunter, DeMille, Morel, Flynn. Rhys looked at the man in the wheelchair.
Can't have my customers seeing commercial fiction on my shelves. Bad for business.
Rhys reached in and pulled out an old H&K G3 with wood furniture. This sighted in?
No. The weapons arrive as they are.
Rhys tossed it on Abelard's desk behind him. Same with this? Rhys asked, pulling out an H&K MP5 SD.
Yes.
Rhys's eyes settled on a weapon he knew well. A Benelli M1 Super 90. No sling, rifle sights, extended magazine.
Rhys grabbed the shotgun and checked its condition. Empty. Do you have shells for this?
Yes, in the back.
Rhys reached into the back top shelf and pulled out a box of double-aught and a box of slugs. Moving to the desk, Rhys set the 12-gauge autoloader and the two boxes of shells on the table. He grabbed a double-aught shell, hit the shell release lever of the right side of the black shotgun, threw in the shell, and hit the bolt release, which sent the shell containing 9 lead pellets into the chamber. Pulling the shotgun back under his arm for stability, Rhys reached back into the box and began to feed shells into the tube. Seeing movement at the door, Rhys brought the shotgun to his shoulder. One round in the chamber, only one in the tube. Off safe. The door swung open, the bell ringing to announce that a customer or customers had arrived. Instead of a hitman or a group of assassins, 3 boys closing in on 10 years old entered. Their hair, eyes, and skin indicated Middle Eastern ancestry. Their laughter signaled the innocent exuberance of youth. The boy in the middle was wearing a smile, a Juventus Football Club jersey, and a backpack. Chapter 57.
Le diatosil,
the boy said, unslinging the backpack and running toward them. I have a delivery. Rhys caught the P-7 coming up from Abelard to his left in his peripheral vision. He saw Lauren and Lucy riddled with bullets. Innocents. Rhys knocked Abelard's pistol down, dropped the shotgun, and ran toward the 3 children, who all had abject looks of horror on their faces as the big man barreled down on them. Who gave you this? Rhys shouted as he approached, pointing at the backpack. The boy froze in his tracks and said something in Arabic that Rhys did not understand. The 2 friends turned to run back to the door. Their smiles were gone. Rhys processed the terror in the young boy's eyes as he grabbed the backpack. Heavy. The boy was pointing outside. His friends had reached the door. You can't throw this into the street after those kids. Rhys turned and ran back into the store, past the desk.
What are you doing? Abelard shouted. Get that out of here!
Rhys threw the backpack into the open safe, slammed the door, spun the locking handle to the left, and felt the bolts engage, locking them in place. Out! Rhys shouted, pointing at the door. The boy stood frozen in his tracks. Just as Rhys reached down to pick him up and carry him to safety, the bomb detonated. Chapter 58. Oleg Burzin watched the 3 children enter the shop via the camera sending signals to his smartphone. Their job was to deliver the backpack to the 2 men inside and run out of the store. He had given each of the refugee children 10 euros, a fortune to the new arrivals from war-torn Syria. When Oleg saw them exit, he would detonate the IED. One of the Syrian men entering the shop would set off alarm bells for certain. Oleg still looked twice, sometimes 3 times, at men and women who triggered memories of the Hindu Kush, dismembered bodies of Soviet soldiers on the roadsides, the Spetsnaz troops hanging from trees, skinned alive, their genitals cut from between their legs and stuffed in their mouths. The American would look twice, Oleg knew. The Jew, perhaps. But the bookseller had lived in the neighborhood for long enough that he might be accustomed to the growing immigrant population. Oleg had no intention of killing the children. In his youth, he had no doubt he would have triggered the explosive with the boys still inside. He may have even done it a year ago. That was the correct tactical decision. It was also the correct strategic decision, as it would confirm that Syrian immigrants had targeted a Jewish shop where an American just so happened to be buying books at the wrong time. Intelligence services might be able to discern that there was more to the bombing, but to the general public it would feed into the narrative of radical Islamic terror cells working in Europe targeting Jewish people and businesses. It was not the first time, and it would not be the last. Oleg told himself that this way worked as well. As the children exited, he would be able to see that the backpack was no longer worn by the oldest. That would be Oleg's signal to detonate. Then he could get back to Brindisi, back to his wife and stepchildren, back to his boxing gym, where he belonged.
What is this?
Oleg looked down at his smartphone. 2 of the kids had scampered out of the store.
Where is the 3rd?
Where is the backpack?
Oleg thought of his comrades swinging in the breeze, ropes around their necks. He saw the birds fly away from their heads, their mutilated groins, and their assholes as he approached. Their eyes had already been picked out of their heads, the birds going to the softest areas first, the eyes, genitals, and anus. He remembered the black tulips taking off from Bagram filled with Soviet dead, dead that the USSR had not acknowledged to the world. The black tulip was an Antonov An-12, a four-engine cargo plane that transported those killed in action back to the motherland.
Cargo 200. Corpses.
Oleg pressed the button. Chapter 59. The transmitter sent a signal to the receiver in the backpack, which completed the circuit and drove an electrical current through the wires into the steel wool. Triacetone triperoxide is a sensitive compound. The ignition of the steel wool created a spark that detonated the TATP and triggered a chemical reaction, which resulted in energy that propagated a shockwave, turning the nails, nuts, and bolts into shrapnel. To everyone in the vicinity, it was an explosion. For the three closest to the detonation, it felt like the end of the world. Rhys had one hand on the boy when the shockwave sent him careening into a bookshelf. The safe did not contain the explosion. The energy found the path of least resistance, which was around the seals of the door. The hinges, designed to be opened outward, did just that, and the safe deformed and turned the steel door into a projectile, shooting it across the shop and destroying everything in its path. Books disintegrated, filling the air with torn covers as pages floated through the smoke. The door continued its push through the front wall, taking the front window with it before landing in the street. The ringing in Reese's ears let him know he was still alive. Did he have all his body parts? He quickly assessed the damage, starting with his feet and working his way up to his head. All fingers and toes intact. He rolled onto his stomach and pushed himself to a kneeling position. The ringing. Where's the kid? Where's a weapon? Rhys crawled over the debris. Papers still fluttered to the ground and settled on the floor, some on fire, some not. A body. A small body. He rolled the child over, his eyes scanning the figure for obvious injuries as he felt a pulse. Good pulse, thank God. Unconscious. Rhys heard a coughing behind him.
Abelard! Saul!
I'm here, he said between coughs. Those bastards. I had a first edition Confessions by St. Augustine in there. Where's my chair?
Get a gun, Rhys. The kids were the first wave. More will be coming. Rhys rose to a crouch and picked the boy up, moving him next to Abelard and carefully laying him down next to the bookseller.
This kid tried to kill us,
Abelard said. He's just a tool, Rhys responded, in a desperate search for the weapons and ammo he had laid out on the desk prior to the explosion. A maneuver element will be coming to finish us off.
How do you know?
Because that's what I'd do. The desk had been turned over in the explosion. Small fires burned as the parchments became fuel to keep them alive.
Chair,
Rhys said as he shook off Abelard's wheelchair and turned to help him into it.
Get off me,
the bookseller said, shaking off Rhys's helping hand.
I can do this myself. Find a weapon.
Rhys turned as Abelard hoisted himself up and into his chair.
Shotgun.
Rhys picked up the Benelli from the floor and gave it a shake to free it of debris. It was still on safe. The former SEAL cracked the bolt to ensure the round he had already loaded was still in the chamber. He flipped it upside down. The shell he had loaded into the magazine tube was still there.
Need more rounds.
Rhys began to scour the floor for shotgun shells.
There.
The explosion had blown the two boxes from the desk as it was upended and sent them scattering across the shop. Rhys picked one up.
Double-aught.
He loaded it into the magazine tube.
Another one.
Slug. Rhys deposited it in his back right pocket as he continued his search. Two more, both double-aught. He saw the boy begin to stir.
Ask him how many people he saw when he was asked to deliver the backpack,
Rhys shouted at Abelard as he continued to comb the floor for ammunition. Rhys heard Abelard talking to the boy in Arabic, his voice low and soothing. Rhys glanced over, The smoke had begun to dissipate. The young courier appeared to be in shock.
Need intel on what's coming.
There, a box of shells. Reese moved to it and loaded 3 more rounds of double-aught into the tube to top it off, giving him a total of 7 in the tube and 1 in the chamber. 8. Reese looked at the hole in the wall and at the front door, which was also blown from its hinges. The front of the store was almost entirely open, the books that had been arranged in the windows blown from their displays. With the windows gone and a section of the wall missing, there was not much in the form of cover. The smoke and ash that gave them their concealment was dissipating and exposing them to the street.
"What's he saying?"
Reese shouted as he retracted the charging handle to the point just prior to where the shell carrier was designed to lift. He depressed the shell that was in the chamber into the shell carrier, keeping the fingers of his left hand pressing it downward while sliding the new round into the chamber and allowing the bolt to go forward over the floating shell in the shell carrier. Reese hit the charging handle with his palm to confirm it was firmly seated. It was called ghost loading, and it gave Reese 9 rounds in what was typically considered to be an 8-round weapon system with which to get to work. There were 4 more shells in the box. Reese stuffed them into his front left pocket. Abelard had continued to talk with the boy, gently coaxing information from him. Reese did 1 more check of the shotgun.
Focus.
What did he say? Reese asked again.
He said, "One of the men is a friend of his father. He doesn't remember how many others. He said they paid him 10 euros to bring the backpack here. He was instructed to leave it here and then continue home."
That helps a little, more than one, Reese thought.
He said something else.
What?
He told me that one of the men was like you, Abyad.
What's that mean, like me?
Abyad, a white man.
A white man? The Frenchman?
Movement at the side window.
Take care of the boy.
Reese pushed himself over the mounds of smoking debris and approached the front of the store, sinking to a knee behind a smoldering bookshelf.
Find my pistol,
he heard Abelard say. The figure approaching the store could just be a concerned citizen coming to help. It could be a police officer or first responder. But it wasn't.
Identify the target, Reese.
A man in a long coat. Still not 100%, could be a good Samaritan. Reese saw the coat part and clearly identified the underfolder Kalashnikov.
Enemy.
Reese brought the shotgun to his shoulder, pushed the safety to the fire position, lined up the rifle-style sights, and pressed the trigger. 9 lead .33-inch pellets jettisoned across the store. 4 of them caught the man on the right side of his face, ripping half of his skull away from his head and sending him to the ground in a heap.
Shoot and move.
Reese moved past Abelard and the boy. He rotated, lined up the sights, and pressed the trigger, sending another tightly grouped pattern into the upper chest of the downed man, just to be sure. He took a knee against what was left of the doorframe and put another round in the tube from his left pocket. His head was up, looking for additional threats.
The boy didn't remember how many others, Reese. That suggests more than one. And one was Abyad.
Automatic rifle fire stitched up the side of the doorframe next to Reese and zipped past him into the store.
Get that kid down!
Reese shouted to Abelard. Reese saw the shooter from across the street. The folding stock was extended and was firmly planted in his shoulder. The streets of Borgo Dora in the Aurora district of Turin had become a war zone. Another burst of fire erupted from an alley on Reese's side of the street just past the corner of the store.
L ambush.
Decision time.
Take a breath, look around, make a call. Draw the fire away from the boy.
Reese bolted from his position, sending the 12-gauge projectiles across the street toward the man in the far alley, and then immediately shifted back to the corner wall where he had last seen the shooter on his side of the street.
If they kill you, Abelard, and probably the boy are going down too. Kill them all, Reese.
There was no past, no future, only the now. Only the operation of the Benelli autoloading shotgun, working as designed in concert with an operator who made it an extension of his body. Reese pressed the trigger as he moved, counting the shells remaining in the combat shotgun, beginning to feel the heat through the black composite handguard, just as his father had used the Ithaca Model 37 as a point man in the jungles of Vietnam. His son now worked one of its descendants in the streets of Turin against a different enemy. the buckshot sailing through the air just as it had done in Southeast Asia, destroying anything in its path. Reese took a wide angle on the wall as he pressed the trigger again to keep his assailant behind cover. The shot worked as intended, impacting the corner of the wall. As Reese approached an optimal angle, he saw the man with an AK crouched down. 9 balls of lead shot took him in the right shoulder and upper chest, opening him up for Reese's next shot, which removed most of his head. The former SEAL spun around back to the threat across the street. "Where is he?" Reese loaded the 2 remaining shells from his left pocket into the tube. 4 shells left in the shotgun, 1 slug in his back pocket. "Grab an AK." "Not yet. Still an active threat. Wait until there's a tactical pause." Reese moved behind a delivery van that had pulled up to the shop next to Abelard's. "Where are you?" Reese turned to maneuver around the far side of the truck and ran directly into a jihadi with a rifle who had taken the corner of the vehicle. As the 2 killers collided, both their weapons were knocked offline, Reese's pointing down and his assailant's AK pointing up. The former SEAL's aggression, size, and strength dominated the fight. Reese used the side of his Benelli to trap the AK against the man, whom Reese had now pinned to the side of the van. Reese dropped his shotgun, his left hand forcing the AK barrel under his enemy's chin as his right thumb dropped into the trigger guard and pressed back on the trigger. The firing pin engaged with a burst of fully automatic 7.62x39 rounds through his brain, exiting out the top of his skull and sending chunks of blood, skull fragments, and brain matter onto Reese's face and the side of the delivery vehicle. The body slumped to the ground. Reese quickly unslung the AK. Before he could check its status, he heard the familiar scream of "Allahu Akbar!" But it was not coming for him, it was coming from the direction of the store. Reese turned, flipped the AK to semi-automatic, brought the rifle up, found the front sight, led his target ever so slightly, and stitched the man up his left side. The first round was low, breaking his hip and sending him crashing to the ground on the ramp of the bookstore. Reese's next round entered through the man's rib cage. Reese continued to work rounds up to his lungs, heart, and head, which exploded against the base of the doorframe. Reese heard the click of his empty Kalashnikov, followed by footsteps from the corner of the vehicle. He dropped the AK and picked up the Benelli. Unable to swing the shotgun in time to engage his new target, Reese launched himself up and into his assailant's body, leading with the side of the shotgun like a pugil stick directly into the man's face. Reese felt the cartilage of the nose breaking. He expected the aggressor to attempt to turn the AK to shoot, but instead the man dropped it, both hands going to the shotgun. In the close-quarter confines at the corner of the vehicle, Reese used the man's energy, turning the shotgun sharply like a driver turning a steering wheel when trying to avoid an accident. The violent move turned his opponent in the opposite direction, allowing Reese to twist and throw him over his hip to the pavement. The aggressive rotation forced the man to let go of the shotgun and allowed Reese to step back and shoot him in the head. From 2 feet away, the 9 pellets that tore through his skull ensured there was no need for a security round. Reese was about to reach down and pick up the AK when he heard a child's voice screaming. In a crouch, he moved to the corner of the van and took a quick peek from behind his cover. The shooter who had first engaged him from across the street was walking toward him. In his right hand, in the position of retention against his body, was the AK. In his left was one of the boys who had first entered the shop. Human shield. He saw Reese and adjusted the position of the AK, sending a fully automatic burst into the rear quarter panel of the van, but the SEAL had already moved. As Reese relocated to the front right section of the vehicle, he reached into the back right pocket of his pants with his primary hand and removed the slug. Controlling the shotgun with his left hand, he racked the charging handle with his right, catching the double-aught shell that ejected from the chamber and replacing it with the slug. Reese quickly reinserted the ejected shell into the tube and emerged from the opposite side of the van. The terrorist holding the child caught Reese's movement and spun to face him, the boy shielding most of his body and part of his face. "Slow is smooth, smooth is fast." Reese's vision focused on the front sight, his breath settled, as the assailant's AK continued to turn, bullets beginning to chew into the street and van working their way toward him. As Reese's finger pressed back on the trigger, he heard the immortal wisdom of Wyatt Earp. "Fast is fine, but accuracy is final. In a gunfight, you must learn to be slow in a hurry. The modern-day gunfighter felt his shoulder absorb the recoil, the 1-ounce lead projectile exiting the end of the barrel. At 25 yards, the slug made an almost instant connection with his assailant's right eye, plowing through the ocular cavity and brain before blowing through the back of the skull. The effect was like unplugging a lamp. No more power or commands could be sent to the rest of the body. The massive slug took out the brain's central processing unit. It was instant death. The man dropped to the ground. Gravity took the boy with him. He landed awkwardly atop the dead terrorist. Reese took a step and was stopped short by the sound of gunfire behind him, shattering the side window of the van. He felt a slap and searing pain in the upper left side of his back. He immediately dropped to the ground to make himself less of a target. 2 shells left. Reese rolled onto his stomach, shotgun stock in his shoulder. The first body parts in his sights were the knees of a man running toward him. Reese pressed the trigger. The man stumbled. Reese raised the shotgun a bit higher and fired 9 lead balls at 1,600 feet per second into his assailant's upper thigh, groin, and hips, sending him to the ground. Reese pushed himself to his feet. His left shoulder felt almost numb. The Benelli had locked back, empty. Reese left it on the ground and moved quickly to the downed man who was still alive in front of him. A crowd had begun to form at the end of the alley, most people being smart enough to keep their distance from explosions and automatic weapons fire. Reese could hear sirens in the distance. Work fast. Reese relieved him of his Kalashnikov and quickly patted him down, looking for additional weapons. He found a knife in the man's belt, pulled it out, and threw it under the van. Reese then grabbed him by the back of his jacket and dragged him through the street and into the bookshop, leaving a trail of blood in their wake. Chapter 60. Oleg watched the scene unfold in disbelief.
The chip blood! These savages never could get anything right.
The former GRU man had watched the shooters converge on the bookshop. It was a shame to have to kill the boy, but that was not something to be overly concerned about. Besides, he was probably being groomed to one day point an AK or blow himself up and kill one of Oleg's stepchildren.
That's one savage who will never point a gun at a son of yours, Oleg.
He remembered an old Spetsnaz colonel telling him in Afghanistan the first time the sergeant had killed a child. This was no different.
Just confirm the dead and be done with it, Oleg thought,
as he continued to watch the screen of his smartphone from the far corner of the cafe. Other patrons had walked to the windows and some had spilled out into the streets after hearing the violent commotion. Many were on their phones, no doubt calling the Italian national emergency numbers for police and medical assistance.
That's it, Oleg thought, continuing to look at his screen. Keep the AK out of sight unless you need it. Only take it out once you enter to ensure our targets are dead.
It took a moment for Oleg to register what was going on. He watched the black and white high-resolution feed as the lead Syrian's head snapped back and he dropped to the street.
Blyat!
He watched as a man bolted from the bombed-out store with what looked to be a long gun of some sort in his shoulder. Even on the video feed, Oleg could tell by the way he moved that this man knew what he was doing.
The American.
Oleg watched as his force went down one by one, each one dispatched by the ghostly black-and-white image on his video feed. At one point it looked like the last assailant had the drop and that the American was hit. Then Oleg saw the Syrian fall to the ground. He watched the American move to him and drag him off video into the bookshop.
These fucking savages.
Oleg looked into the leather satchel he had set next to him in the cafe, the dark steel of the AK waiting to be unleashed. He thought of landing in Bagram, his Spetsnaz training, his multiple tours in a losing war. He thought of the years that followed and all he had done for his homeland. He thought of his new life, his wife, and stepchildren in their home by the sea.
There is no choice.
The Russian left 5 euros on the table, stood up, and slung his satchel over his shoulder, feeling the familiar weight of the fully loaded Kalashnikov next to his body. Keeping his cell phone in his left hand to continue monitoring the front and back of the bookshop, He exited into the street. Chapter 61.
It's me, Reese shouted, as he dragged the terrorist up the ramp and into what was left of the bookshop. Abelard lowered the P-7, which he had recovered from amid the rubble. The boy, who had carried the backpack, was propped against the far wall, and Abelard was positioned next to him.
He's still in shock. I found your leather jacket and covered him. That's the best I could do for now. Emergency services should be here any minute.
Which means we need to work fast, Reese said, performing a press check to ensure there was a round chambered. He then ejected the magazine and pressed down on the top bullet. His fingers pushed down about 2 inches. At least there were a few rounds to work with. Ask this fucker about the white man and ask him if there are any more in the hit team.
How many did you kill out there?
6, plus this asshole who won't be with us much longer, Reese said, looking to the front of the shop.
I take back what I said about Americans and poker, Abelard said.
Ask him, quick! Reese listened as he continued to watch the front. Abelard fired off questions in rapid Arabic. Gone were the soothing tones he used to talk with the boy.
Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Upon them will be the blessings and mercy of their Lord, and it is they who are rightly guided.
He just keeps reciting the istirja, Abelard said.
What's that?
A Quranic death verse.
Reese heard a suppressed gunshot and spun. Abelard had put a 9mm round from his H&K pistol through the terrorist's hand.
I can't do much from this chair in a fight, but I can do this, he said.
He continued to talk to the man in Arabic.
He said he's the last one. They are from Syria.
Syria? Do you think he's telling the truth? Reese asked.
I have no idea.
Ask him about the white man. Was he French? Abelard exchanged words with their wounded prisoner yet again.
He says no, not French. Russian.
Russian?
What have you done to upset the bear? Abelard asked.
I'm sure plenty, but nothing to warrant this. The prisoner's eyes rolled back in his head as he bled out. Death had found him on the floor of a bombed-out bookstore in Turin.
We need to get out of here, Mr. Donovan. Those sirens are almost here.
Do you have binos?
Binos?
You know, binoculars.
I do.
Where?
Bottom left desk drawer, Abelard replied.
Reese took one more look through the blown-out front windows and moved to the overturned desk. He bent down to turn it over.
What do you keep in this thing?
Reese asked as he strained to lift it. The numbness in his left shoulder was wearing off and giving way to sharp pain.
You're bleeding, Abelard said.
Reese lifted the desk using the right side of his body. After it fell back upright, he went around it and yanked open the lower left side drawer. He dug around until he came up with an old pair of Leica binoculars. He then moved back toward Abelard to get a better angle on the far end of the alley. People had started to inch closer to the commotion now that the explosions and automatic weapons fire had subsided. Most were looking at the devastation and dead bodies that littered the street. Some had phones to their ears. Others had their phones out in front of them, taking video of the carnage. One was doing none of those things. A single man, short, stocky, with a leather messenger bag slung cross-body over his shoulder, had his head down toward his phone. He didn't look to be the type of man who would be lost scrolling a social media app while the world burned. When he picked his head up, Reese adjusted the focus. Early 60s, square jaw, cauliflower ears, white. Chapter 62. Oleg maneuvered through the crowd, watching the video feed on his phone, working out contingencies and possibilities.
Not much time, Oleg. Authorities will be here soon. No Russian fingerprints. No mission failure, either. Moscow does not deal kindly with those who failed the state.
He was up against a man who had just killed 6, and now quite possibly 7, armed men in the streets of Italy.
James Reese.
No one had come or gone from the bookshop since the American had dragged the last Syrian inside.
He has got to want to get out of there as much as you want him to come out. He just killed 6 or 7 people with what was sure to be an illegal weapon on foreign soil. CIA man or not, that was bound to cause a host of diplomatic and legal issues. Bring him to you, Oleg. Why run when you can stand and fight?
Oleg continued to walk down the narrow street, still in the crowd, but well aware that he was standing out. He thought of ambushes, of downed Hind helicopters, Stinger missiles, dead and disfigured comrades. When he reached the halal butcher shop that was catty-corner from Abelard's, he broke with the crowd and hustled inside.
"Is that the man?" Rhys asked the child, whom he now held in his right arm. The young courier had recovered enough to be able to nod. The life had returned to his eyes. Abelard translated into Arabic. The boy had the Leica binoculars to his eyes, following the white man with the satchel down the street. He dropped the binoculars and spoke in Arabic to the bookseller.
"That's him," Abelard said. "Now let's get out of here."
"Please tell him thank you, and let him know that he is very brave," Rhys said.
Abelard said something in Arabic. The boy smiled and went back to his corner, pulling the leather jacket over his shoulders.
"And us?" Abelard asked.
"What did Tel Aviv mean when they said to assist me in any way you could?"
"I am not sure they had this in mind," Abelard said, indicating the destruction around them. "This might be the end of my information brokering days. Might have to make an honest living restoring books.
In the meantime, does that butcher shop across the street have a back exit?"
"It does."
"What's there?" Rhys asked.
"An alley."
"Good."
"He's drawing you in, Mr. Donovan."
"I know," Rhys said.
Moving to the door, he reached down and took the magazine from the weapon of the first man he had killed, the man who was now missing the right side of his head and never got a shot off. Rhys removed the magazine from his AK and stowed it in his back pocket. He then pressed down on the top round to ensure the newly pilfered magazine was fully loaded before rocking it into place. Performing a press check to ensure there was a round in the chamber, Rhys sprinted across the street in pursuit of the Russian. Chapter 63. It's an odd feeling to know you are walking into an ambush. It was also one Rhys knew well. Every time he had led a sniper team into Ramadi at the height of the war, he had this same sensation. They would drop over the walls of the American compound and into Ramadi in the dark of night to avoid the base gates. Rhys and his team would then be enveloped by a city where every step could trigger an IED and every angle could put you in the enemy's crosshairs. He felt the same way now. The sirens were close. Rhys entered the butcher shop. The difference between now and Ramadi was that in Ramadi, when Rhys's platoon came under fire, they responded with overwhelming firepower and violence of action. Today, if Rhys killed the Russian, his secrets died with him. Rhys entered and immediately cleared his corner and then pivoted back to his right to clear the rest of the room. It was not a good technique for clearing rooms or structures alone. A slow, deliberate combat clearance was much more effective, unless there were hostages. Then the game changed. Or if the Italian police were inbound. Rhys did not want to get caught up in an Italian legal quandary. He needed to find out why someone in Russia wanted him dead, and he needed to kill Nizar Catan. The butcher shop was seemingly empty, everyone having fled as the building across from them exploded. Halal meat stood out in prominent bold letters above a refrigerated, glassed-in display filled with various meats, including a series of lamb's heads, their lifeless eyes taking in the room. Chalkboards behind the counter gave prices of the various cuts, primarily lamb and goat. Sodas were stacked against the base of the display, and there were 5 short aisles of foodstuffs, as in any small market the world over. Was the Russian running out the back, or was he lying in wait? Rhys got his answer in gunfire. The distinctive sound of an AK exploded from a hallway at the back of the store, followed by smaller caliber shots. Pistols, Rhys made his decision. Run to the sound of the guns. Rhys moved toward the fight, Kalashnikov up and off safe, finger on the trigger. More rifle and pistol gunfire. What the hell is going on? Then Rhys saw movement. Polizia di Stato, Italian police. A uniformed patrolman was rushing to a downed man in the hallway. As he reached down to grab him, a burst of AK fire took him in the upper chest, his body contorting around the impacts to what Reese deduced was body armor under his uniform. Reese briefly made eye contact before another burst tore through the policeman's head, his body going straight to the ground atop the man he was trying to save. Two more men entered the hallway, firing 9mm Beretta 92FS pistols.
No!
Reese shouted, but they never heard him. The 7.62x39 rounds from an AK taking one through the throat and the other in the face. More movement. A man entered the hallway, reaching down for one of the fallen officer's handguns. The man was not in the uniform of an Italian police officer. He was the Russian the boy had pointed out to Reese moments earlier. Reese raised his rifle and pressed the trigger, but the Russian had seen the upward swing of Reese's weapon and thrown himself back into the room across the hall.
He was going for a battlefield pickup and he didn't have his AK in hand. He's out of ammo.
Rifle up and off safe, finger on the trigger, Reese moved down the hallway.
Closed door long, he thought to himself. Open door right.
He angled in on the corner.
Combat clearance, don't rush to your death.
Reese cleared as much of the room as he could, well aware that additional Italian police officers would be converging on the site at any moment. He needed to find the Russian and interrogate him before the police arrived and arrested or killed them both. Reese committed to the room, clearing the unknown spaces he could not see from outside before entering. Stainless steel tables covered in dead chickens and knives were set up around a large, grated drain in the center of the floor. A hose with a high-pressure nozzle attached lay abandoned nearby. An AK and a magazine were next to it. The Russian had run out of ammo, ejected the magazine to check, and then dropped them both to go for a police officer's Beretta.
But where did he go? He couldn't have just disappeared.
The walk-in freezer.
Cops will be here any minute, Reese. You lose this guy, you lose any chance of finding out why someone in the Russian government wants you dead. You will never know peace. Katie will always be at risk.
Reese moved to the side of the freezer. Should he fire through the door? Would the rounds penetrate?
Probably.
What if some kid or the shopkeepers or butchers had taken refuge in there?
Damn it!
Reese's hand went to the handle, and he pulled the heavy door open.
Combat clearance, Reese.
As he angled on the space, he was met by row upon row of beef carcasses hanging from hooks on rails.
Enter or get out of here. Time is running out.
Reese entered and cleared his left corner. He was hit from the right side immediately. The door swung shut, leaving him and his opponent in the meat locker in complete darkness. Chapter 64. Reese felt like he had been hit by a freight train. The two bodies crashed through one carcass and then another before landing on the frozen floor of the meat locker. Reese felt a jolt of pain shoot through his injured back. The AK did not have a sling, and Reese lost his grip on it in the dark as his breath was knocked out, his diaphragm contracting in a spasm.
Find the rifle!
Reese had pushed himself to his knees and was struggling for breath when he felt a hand on his leg. Someone else was also pushing himself to his feet in the darkness. The blow to the side of Reese's head landed a second later. They were fighting using senses other than sight, so the strike that might have killed him glanced off the side of his head.
He's going to follow up. Don't be in the same place when he does.
Reese stood and attempted to get his bearings.
Which way is the door?
Complete disorientation. He didn't have much time to consider his situation as a beef carcass swung into his back, knocking him against the wall. The Russian heard the impact and was on him. Oleg's iron fist smashed into Reese's ribs as the Russian landed a hook, then pivoted and landed another on the side of Reese's head. Had Reese not had his left hand covering his jaw, it would have been lights out. He dropped his hip and shot an uppercut with his right to his aggressor's midsection, which the Russian absorbed like it was nothing. He felt Oleg's hand slip down and latch onto his throat, squeezing the life from him and pinning him to the wall.
This guy is a monster.
Reese grabbed the top of Oleg's hand with his right in the dark while raising his left arm and slamming his elbow down onto the crook of the Russian's arm, breaking the grip from his throat. Reese wrapped his left arm around his opponent's right, his hand on the back of the Russian's shoulder, bringing the body down, where Reese delivered a strike with his fist and then a forearm to the side of the Russian's massive head. Reese then slid his right hand to the Russian's back under his own left hand, which was still trapping the Russian's shoulder. He drove his right knee into his aggressor's solar plexus, and then twisted his body, sending the Russian's head into the wall behind him. Reese lost physical contact with his opponent in the darkness.
Where are you?
Reese felt the jab connect with his cheek.
There you are.
He knew the likelihood of a follow-up cross was high. Bobbing his head back and to the left, he felt the energy of the Russian's punch just miss him in the darkness. He felt a cold carcass on his left shoulder and swung it toward where he thought the Russian was standing. He could hear it hit something, but didn't know if it was his adversary or another side of beef. Something brushed against him to his right, something that was warmer than the beef. Covering his jaw with his left hand, Reese pivoted right and drove an uppercut into the body. It was a solid connection, and the Russian grunted in response, before sending a left hook glancing off Reese's shoulder. He quickly recocked to send another to the side of the American's head. Stars filled Reese's vision, and he careened into a slab of cold beef.
Stay in it, Reese. You go down, you die.
Reese could feel the Russian coming toward him in the pitch-black confines of the meat locker and threw a jab, feeling nose cartilage breaking beneath his knuckles. The Russian kept coming. Reese followed it with a cross, his opponent slipping it in the darkness, dropping his weight, and firing a cross of his own into Reese's solar plexus. Reese covered with an elbow, keeping them tight to his body. The two warriors traded punches in the dark.
This guy is a boxer. He's a better boxer than you. Don't fight his fight. Close the distance.
Knowing what to do and then attempting to do it without the sense of sight, while heavy meat carcasses are swinging to knock you off balance and a trained fighter is moving in for the kill, is another matter entirely. Reese felt a solid jab to his jaw and knew the cross was coming. This time, instead of covering and countering, Reese changed levels and ducked his chin to his chest, launching the top part of his head forward and into the incoming fist of the Russian boxer in a Filipino destruction technique. The Russian grunted in pain, clearly hurt, but instead of grabbing what may have been a broken hand, he sent Reese to the ground with a shot to the liver with his good fist. Reese felt a cold sensation flow through his body. As he fought to stand, his head was viciously yanked back by his hair. Three devastating punches connected with his face and dropped him to the deck. But the Russian had made a mistake. He had closed the distance. Reese grabbed for the Russian's foot and found it in the darkness, moving his hand to the ankle and scooping it while driving forward in an ankle pick, taking his opponent to the floor. It was now all about feel. It was Reese's game now. Pulling himself atop the downed Russian, Reese found the mount and rained down a flurry of punches into the man's face before switching to more devastating elbows, causing the Russian to lock up Reese's body.
This guy is a beast!
Pushed up and out of the mount, Reese found himself on his butt. With the sense of sight out of play, Reese's other senses were heightened. Touch, sound, and the sense of spatial awareness took over as the Russian drove himself toward Reese, who wrapped his arm around his enemy's thick neck in a right-side guillotine choke. Reese planted his left arm on the floor and threw his right hip up, and then sat back, cutting the angle toward his right hip while wrapping his legs around the Russian. He pulled his elbow back. Feeling his opponent's head twisting, he switched from a wrist grip to a gable grip. The Russian fired two short punches into Reese's ribs and wrapped his arms around Reese's body, his fingers finding the bullet wound in Reese's upper back and digging inside. Reese pushed through the pain as the Russian clawed deeper into Reese's back, pushing his head free. Reese adjusted, pulling the Russian into his guard. He took another punch to the face, but caught it before his adversary could retract it and locked it to his body. Reese quickly pivoted his hips and spun toward the Russian's left knee, throwing his left leg over the Russian's neck in and outward right armbar, and driving his hips to the opposite wall with all the power he could muster. Reese's violent effort was rewarded with a loud snap as the ligaments ruptured and tendons tore, dislocating the elbow. Reese kicked the heavy Russian back into a hanging side of beef and frantically felt along the floor for the AK. The Russian was doing the same thing. Unfortunately for Reese, the GRU man found it first. Reese heard the metal of the Kalashnikov's receiver scraping along the floor.
He's hurt, The first shots are not going to be accurate. All he needs to do is get lucky once. You have seconds.
Rhys stood and began shoving beef carcasses in the direction of the Russian. Swinging right and left as they slid along their rails, they began impacting the assassin, just as he cradled the rifle in his broken arm and pressed the trigger with his left index finger. The noise of the unsuppressed AK firing fully automatic in a confined space was deafening. Bullets tore through the hanging carcasses, the muzzle flash igniting the darkness like a strobe light. That strobe illuminated the door to the meat locker. It was directly behind Rhys. The frogman turned and bailed out of the locker, slamming the door shut behind him to buy a few more seconds. He assessed his injuries as he ran. Nothing seemed to be broken, but he was having trouble moving his left arm. As he passed one of the metal tables covered in dead chickens, Rhys grabbed a cleaver. Chapter 65. Rhys burst into the hallway and leapt over the dead police officers as he heard the door to the meat locker open. Turning to his right, he saw the back exit, sprinted to it, and, with his left side not working well and his right hand holding the large meat cleaver, he kicked it open and exited into a back alley. Two unoccupied police cars were parked haphazardly at one end of the narrow street. Rhys positioned himself to the left side of the door. Stand and fight. AK versus meat cleaver. American versus Russian. SEAL versus some sort of Russian special operator. Rhys was sure of it. As the door flew open, Rhys took advantage of the Russian's mind being in another type of fight, a gunfight. Rhys was prepared for a different kind of battle. Pinning the AK to the Russian's body, he brought the rectangular cleaver down toward the Russian's head, but instead connected with the left side clavicle, which snapped under the heft and downward pressure of the sharp blade. The Russian screamed in pain and launched himself into Rhys with a fury known only to a cornered animal, knocking the SEAL into the wall. With both sides of his upper body devastated by Rhys's attacks, he pivoted his hips and threw a tie kick that connected with Rhys's sciatic nerve and dropped him to the cobblestone alley. As Rhys pushed himself up, he saw the Russian positioning the AK from his hip. Rhys saw Lauren and Lucy holding hands in Coronado, and he saw Katie by the lake in Montana, a light breeze blowing through her hair. A gunshot brought him back to reality, but it wasn't the sound of a Kalashnikov. It was a pistol. The bullet hit the Russian in the right shoulder from behind. A second gunshot took him closer to the spine, spinning him back toward the door and dropping him to the ground. Rhys looked over his left shoulder and saw Abelard behind the wheel of a dark vintage Mini Cooper. One hand was on the wheel, and one held the Heckler & Koch P7. "Did you have to shoot him?" Rhys asked.
"You're welcome. And what would you have me do? Allow him to riddle you with bullets? Or perhaps pummel you to death? Maybe I should have asked him nicely to stop?"
"Okay, now what?" Rhys asked, pushing himself to his feet.
"Get him up and in the car.
In this clown car, I don't think we are going to fit."
"Well, I know where we will all fit, in the back of a police car. Get him in here and let's go."
Rhys looked at the large Russian. He was breathing, but he was dead weight.
"Commit to it."
Rhys positioned himself on his back on the Russian's chest. Keeping his hips off the ground, he reached back and grabbed the Russian's far leg, throwing the thigh over his left shoulder. He then raised his right leg up and back and threw it forward, rolling the Russian up and onto his shoulder in a fireman's carry.
"Impressive. Put him in the back seat," Abelard said. "We will stop just outside of the city and see if we can patch him, and you, up. I have some tape and rope in the trunk."
"Back seat?
Just get him in."
Moments after the heavy Russian was stuffed in the back of the Mini Cooper, Rhys climbed in the passenger seat, and Abelard sped out of the city. Chapter 66. Road from Turin, Italy, to Cortina d'Ampezzo, Italy. Cortina d'Ampezzo is a resort town nestled in a valley in the province of Belluno, in the Dolomites of northern Italy. Best known for the cancelled 1944 Winter Olympics due to World War II, it would host the 1956 Games and become a jet-set destination for European aristocrats, models, and the occasional Hollywood star before they opted for the warmer climes of Ibiza, Spain. Rhys and Abelard had exited the A4 about halfway to Milan and pulled into a barn on a dairy farm well off the main road. There they switched out the Mini Cooper for a black Audi RS5 with all the proper paperwork. The Cyan network was strong in Europe. Israel was not about to allow their people to fall victim to another Holocaust. After Abelard checked Rhys's back, noting that the wound was probably the result of a ricochet, he stuffed it with gauze from the small first aid kit in the Mini. While Abelard disconnected his mechanical hand controls from the old Mini and reattached them to the Audi, Rhys pulled their passenger from the back seat and onto the dirt. Thank God they had not been pulled over. Explaining why there was a man bound with duct tape bleeding all over the back seat would have raised a question or two. They needed a trunk, and the Audi gave them one.
Is he alive? Abelard had asked.
Barely, Rhys replied. Isn't there anyone closer?
This is my closest. Usually he's in Milan, but he's fly fishing Lake Misurina and stays at his chateau in the Dolomites this time of year.
Terrific, Rhys said. Is he a Cyan?
No. He's part of a different network not associated with my former agency.
I see. And you trust him?
We would not be driving all this way if I didn't.
Their Russian prisoner had a pulse and seemed to be breathing, but he was drifting in and out of consciousness. Rhys patched and stuffed what he could. I think he's bleeding internally.
Will he make the trip?
The old Mossad man asked. Not sure. How long from here?
About 5.5 hours, and I have to drive the speed limit with him back there.
Let's get moving, Rhys said, removing the spare tire jack and tossing it in the back seat. He then hoisted the Russian into the trunk and slammed it shut. Their journey took them east, passing just south of Lago di Garda. They cut north above Venice and began their trek into the Dolomites. Even in the fading light, Rhys could tell how beautiful it was. Lush, green valleys patched with grapevine-covered hillsides gave way to the sheer walls of the Dolomite Alps. They crossed rivers and streams and passed through small mountain villages as the Audi made short work of the winding mountain roads. I'd love to come back here with Katie, after it's over. Tell me what I'm in for here, Mr. Abelard.
Let's go with Saul. I feel like we're at that stage.
James? James is fine.
Good. We are going to see a doctor who takes care of patients who can't risk a stay at a normal hospital. He's an orthopedic surgeon, specializes in knees. There are a lot of those types of injuries in a ski town.
If business is good, why does he see people like us? Rhys asked.
Good question. Because he was one of us. Not exactly, but close.
What do you mean?
He was a doctor in the Italian military, a maggiore.
A major?
That's right. First a major, as are all the doctors, and then a lieutenant colonel. He was part of SISMI. Do you know what that is?
The Italian Military Intelligence and Security Service. Wasn't it called the AISE?
They had to change the name after the reforms in 2007, Abelard confirmed. The government wanted to bring it under civilian control after a series of scandals.
The Imam Rapito affair?
The very one. He was the SISMI doctor assigned to the operation.
An extraordinary rendition of Abu Omar in 2003 in Milan by SISMI and the CIA, Rhys said. I was in Afghanistan at the time, but I remember the headlines. It brought the agency's rendition program into the light.
Our doctor, Alessandro Catania, was lead medical on the operation and was on the flight with Omar to Egypt.
I don't remember seeing his name in any of the articles I read about it.
That's because his involvement was swept under the rug.
Why's that? A lot of CIA and SISMI names saw the light of day, including the CIA Milan chief of base.
Dr. Catania had another connection to the CIA that no one in either government wanted to see revealed.
What was that? Rhys asked.
What do you know of Sidney Gottlieb?
Rings a bell. Isn't he the mind-control LSD guy from the CIA in the 50s and 60s?
That's him. He was known as the chief poisoner for the CIA. Ran a program called MK Ultra for 20 years at the CIA. Illegal, as it turns out.
The church hearings uncovered it, right? Reese asked. The agency was running tests on citizens without their consent. College students, hospital patients, prisoners, mental patients. I learned a little about this a few years ago.
The church hearings only skimmed the surface, James. It was nasty stuff. It wasn't just about using unwitting test subjects to chronicle the effects of LSD. It was much more.
How do you know so much about this? Reese asked. Abelard smoothly accelerated out of a turn. He looked at his mechanical hand controls and said,
I've had a lot of time to read.
What else was MKUltra experimenting with? Reese asked.
It was really about torture, psychological torture to be more precise, though the physical torture certainly played a part. Gottlieb ran it under the auspices of the CIA's Office of Scientific Intelligence.
I'm already skeptical.
As you should be. They worked with the Army's biowarfare lab to develop a truth serum of sorts. That's what they were looking for, anyway. One could get away with a lot in the early days of the Cold War, James.
Similar to the days after 9/11, Reese said, continuing the thought.
That's right. MKUltra continued the experiments of Imperial Japan and the Nazis. Dachau was a hub of human experimentation. Bastards. There is even evidence that the CIA recruited Nazi doctors after the war, gave them safe passage and new identities to continue the work they had begun on the Jews of Europe and build on it. All in the name of national security.
Reese shook his head, thinking back to his SEAL troop ambushed in the mountains of Afghanistan to cover up experiments that had given his men brain tumors.
These doctors and vivisectionists.
What's that? Reese asked. Abelard paused and cleared his throat.
It's operating or cutting an animal. In this case, Jews. While they are alive for physiological or pathological research. My grandparents never made it out of Dachau, James. Were they part of these experiments? I'll never know.
I'm so sorry.
It really wasn't that long ago. And neither was 9/11.
What does this have to do with our orthopedic surgeon?
Those projects from the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the manipulation of mental states and brain function in pursuit of an elusive truth serum using LSD, cocaine, heroin, THC, or mescaline, in conjunction with electroshock treatment, sleep deprivation, extreme heat and cold, hypnosis, sensory deprivation, solitary confinement, even sexual abuse. Those gave your agency a foundation upon which to build. In the post-9/11 world. They even had the black sites of their day in Fort Clayton, Panama, and Villa Schuster and Camp King in Germany. After September 11th, there was a renewed interest in interrogation and torture, as I am sure you are aware.
So I've heard, Reese said.
All Gottlieb's experiments and Project MKUltra, all based on the Japanese and German human experiments, informed what would happen to enemy combatants in the early days of the War on Terror.
What happened to Gottlieb?
He lost the faith. Retired in 1973, went off the grid, as I understand you Americans are fond of saying. Became a peace activist, even took over the operation of a leper colony in India.
Maybe he was atoning for something.
We've all got to face atonement, James, in this life or the next.
Reese looked at his driver.
Like I said, I've had a lot of time to read.
Didn't he testify at the church hearings? Reese asked.
He did. Under an alias. Said he destroyed most of his records. They let him walk free.
Maybe he kept a few records as insurance.
Perhaps. Whatever he did, he took most of his secrets with him to the grave. He died in 1999.
Of what?
No one knows. No cause of death was listed.
Creepy.
That it is. Those experiments in the church hearings informed the 1994 definition of torture as, and I'm paraphrasing, inflicting pain similar to organ failure or death. After 9/11, that definition was broadly interpreted. If an enemy combatant didn't die or experience organ failure, then it wasn't torture.
You really have had a lot of time to read.
What do you know of Cat's Eye in Thailand?
Black site. One of those top-secret rendition locations that still ended up making the news.
It was one of Abu Zubaydah's first stops after being captured in Pakistan in 2002. They called it Detention Site Green, a CIA prison on the Laotian border about 300 miles northeast of Bangkok. Fell under the jurisdiction of a chief of base who would go on to become the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Most people came to know it as Cat's Eye. It was an old Royal Thai Air Force base in Udon Thani province that last saw extensive use in your Vietnam War. The jungle had reclaimed it by the time the CIA resurrected it. It was the ideal location for a black site. And somehow, Alessandro Catania was involved. He was. The Americans captured another Al-Qaeda operative along with Abu Zubaydah, an Italian citizen, though jihadi to the core. The Italian government was informed and insisted on SISMI involvement in the interrogations. Cat's Eye solved the problem for Italy. The Italian government certainly did not want the circus of a trial on Italian soil, or want to draw Islamic extremist attention to Italy, so they were more than happy to let him rot in Thailand.
And the doctor they sent in was Major Alessandro Catania.
One and the same. Whatever he did there, whatever he saw there, protected him when the Imam Rapito affair in Milan ripped the intelligence services apart. He escaped unscathed, though he did have to resign.
And now he operates on ACLs at the base of the slopes in the Olympic Village.
Yes, though he supplements his income doing the occasional job for me and others like me. Even a case or two for the Italian government, or so it is rumored.
I want to know who sent Ivan back there to kill us, and I want to know if he has any connection to Nizar Khatan.
Well, if anyone can find out, it's Dr. Catania. He is the best I've ever seen when it comes to extracting secrets.
They drove into the resort town just before midnight and found the Cortina d'Ampezzo Orthopedic Center without issue. Abelard pulled around to the back, where a metallic blue Porsche 911 Targa 4 GTS waited.
"I see you've done this before," Rhys said.
"I try not to make it a habit."
Abelard turned off the car.
"Wait here,"
he said, reaching into the back to pull his wheelchair between the seats.
"Need any help?" Rhys asked.
"I've done it a million times," the bookseller said as he opened the door, unfolded the chair, and set it at an angle wedged against the door frame of the German coupe.
He then hoisted himself out of the driver's seat and into the wheelchair. He shut the door and was wheeling toward the back entrance before Rhys could say another word. Rhys was in awe of how Abelard functioned. Other than asking Rhys to find his pistol in the mayhem of the explosion, he had not asked him for help with anything. Rhys found himself forgetting that the man was even in a wheelchair. He adjusted the rearview mirror and watched as the back door opened. Abelard exchanged words with someone and then wheeled back to the Audi. Opening the door, he said,
"Cameras are off. Facility is clear except for the doctor. Let's bring him in."
Rhys exited the vehicle and opened the trunk. The Russian was still unconscious but had a pulse. Rhys struggled to get the body in a position where he could get him up and onto his good shoulder, but he eventually managed. He shut the trunk and walked across the dark parking lot and into the medical facility. A wheeled stretcher awaited.
"Set him down here,"
a heavily accented Italian voice said. Rhys dropped his cargo onto the stretcher and identified the source of the new voice. He had a runner's build and was an inch taller than Rhys. By his thick salt-and-pepper hair, Rhys judged him to be in his late 50s. He wore a white lab coat over dark blue scrubs. Crocs with socks were on his feet. As Rhys extended his hand, the doctor cautioned,
"No names. I want to know as little about you as possible."
"Understood," Rhys said.
"You obviously know my name. It's on the surgery center door and on my coat. Saul has given you my background, I assume."
"He did," Rhys answered.
"My job here is to save this man's life and then use that background to elicit information. Saul is taking care of payment."
Reese looked back at Abelard and then at the doctor.
Someone has to pay for my two ex-wives and make the payment on the targa outside.
He smiled.
Wheel him back, and I'll see what I can do.
Chapter 67. Once in the examination room, Reese stepped back to let Dr. Catania examine the patient. It was obvious even to Reese that the Russian did not have much time. He was pale, his breathing was shallow, and he was already beginning to smell of the dead. Reese and Abelard watched as the doctor cut away the Russian's clothing with practiced precision, leaving him naked on the examination table.
Left upper abdomen, probably a nick to the spleen. Slow trickle, unstoppable bleed, he said. I'd advise you to just ask him when I wake him up, but if he doesn't answer, then you are out of luck.
What do you mean? Reese asked.
What I mean is that if he had more time, we would be able to exercise patience, but he's got minutes, not hours, left.